Well, it's fall, Richard, and you know what that means?
My favorite season is here.
Well, no, that too, probably, but it's time to get back in the swing of things with Bespoke Post. They've got a brand new seasonal box of awesome collections for you guys.
Box of awesome, if you will.
They have boxes of awesome, several boxes of awesome, guaranteed to upgrade your life. You know, I'm a fan of the Bullseye box that they've got on offer right now. You know what that is?
Well, it's a box of knives, so I'm not going to argue with you.
It's a box of throwing knives, cold carbon steel, leather carrying pouch, and a little target that I can whip my cold carbon steel knives at. And
cool stuff.
I'm getting quite good at it, Richard, so I'd advise you not to come near my house.
Yeah, I'm not going to be arguing with a guy with a new box of knives that came in a box of awesome.
Whether it's gear to upgrade your autumn craft beers or cozy threads for when the temperature dips, Bespoke Post only sends guys the best stuff every month. So no matter what you're into, Box of Awesome has you covered. From style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools. They had that
super cool. Is it a skillet?
Yeah. It was a cast iron to
cast make, iron skillet. Making pancakes.
Sounds like fun. Cooking tools, outdoor gear. Box of Awesome has collections for every part of your life. What did you like?
Well, I like the skillet. I mean, it comes with pancake mix. It comes with, I mean, basically everything they have is, you know, it is awesome. But the other super cool thing is that, A, you're getting a deal because you're getting way more than what you're paying. But also, they're helping support small businesses right now. So they're dealing with a lot of different super cool sort of under the radar companies that we'd never come across with super cool stuff. So they kind of do the work for you. And when you're getting your box of awesome, you're also doing something awesome.
Cool. That's really neat. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help them pick the right box of awesome for you. There's new boxes every month across a ton of different categories, like we said. It's free to sign up and you can skip a month or cancel anytime. The boxes, as you say, you get more than what you pay. $70 worth of gear inside, you pay $45. You know, I've got a bunch of money left over from not commuting to work and not paying for gas.
It's odd, eh? We've all saved some money. Not everybody, but a lot of us have saved money that we would have been spending otherwise. So why not treat yourself?
Yeah, this is it's very reasonable. You get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code
What If?
What If at checkout. Yeah, that's boxofawesome.com. Code What If for 20% off your first box. Now, Richard, let's talk about hair loss.
Well, it's something I remember talking about with my barber when I was about 10, 11 years old. I think I was possibly crying. I was complaining about the fact that I had this curly, thick head of hair that you couldn't kind of do anything with. Kids were making fun of me. Said, Richard, let me tell you a story. One day when your friends are there, they're going to be 35, maybe 40 years old, you're going to be making fun of them because they're all going to be going bald.
Because thick, curly hair sticks around? Is that?
Well, like, I mean, the male pattern baldness becomes a thing for, I think it's like 2 out of 3 people.
That's right. No matter what, as guys, you know, your hair is a big part of you. You know, nobody's ready to lose it, but.
No, not readily. Exactly.
No, but it starts in your 20s and 30s. I've noticed that I've got a lot more forehead than I had maybe 10 years ago. So that's why we're excited about Keeps. Keeps is the simple and easy way to keep your hair. Like you said, 2 out of 3 guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness by the time they're 35. That doesn't sound like fun.
No.
The good thing about this one, I thought, was you can get treated from home. So in days gone by, I want to say the olden days, you had to go to your doctor to get a prescription.
Yeah.
And so that could be quite embarrassing.
Or even worse, go to a hair clinic.
Yeah. I remember those commercials for hair clinics. But now you can visit a doctor online and get hair loss medication delivered right to your home. So they deliver it every 3 months. So say goodbye to your pharmacy checkout lines and awkward doctor visits. Prevention is the key.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, who doesn't want to keep their hair?
That's right. So it typically takes between 4 to 6 months to see results. So it's important to act now. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. Find out why Keeps has more 5-star reviews than any of its competitors. And more than 100,000 men trust Keeps for their hair loss prevention medication. Keeps treatments start at just $10 a month. Plus, for a limited time, you can get your first month free.
How promo code?
There's going to be a promo code. Yeah, if you're ready to take action, go to keeps.com/what if. Right, to receive your first month of treatment for free. That's keeps.com/what if. Exactly. Save your hair.
Yes, keep it.
All right, on with the show.
So, Pete, we've been doing the show for a while, right?
Couple months, I guess. Yeah, been fun.
Multiple episodes.
I've been having fun.
I've been having a blast. Hopefully,
learned a lot.
Hopefully, the people listening and watching are having fun. And I also have learned a lot. What I've also learned is that you, amongst others, on the record on the show, saying you believe in the end that there is intelligent life in the universe.
I do.
Outside of Earth.
Outside of Earth, yes. I don't have any proof for it, but I believe it, and I'm not alone. I think, obviously I'm not alone. Tons of other people have believed the same thing. And even just last week, Bill Nye, the science guy, announced it right here on our very show.
And this is new in that, you know, back in the day, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, I don't think you're getting that level of consensus. Certainly not from science people who reserved the need to be credible in whatever field they were in. But now, and really over the last X amount of years, really since Hubble, the math is just too much, right? I mean, it's just overwhelming. It's hard from just a theory of probability that there is just life on this planet in the universe.
It's, well, from what we found out with 200 billion plus galaxies, 200 billion plus stars in each one of those galaxies,
yes.
Plus us finding, planets and exoplanets that are in habitable zones all over the place, it's almost impossible for there not to be life on other planets.
I would agree, but...
But, something's coming.
Do you believe, because that's one thing to say that we believe there's intelligent life in the universe, but what if I told you we have already made contact with aliens in the past?
I don't believe that. I mean, yes. We talked maybe before about what if we are aliens from the past, and I find that could be a probability that, you know, we've evolved so much and gone into the future and then come back to visit ourselves. That maybe, but I haven't heard anything about us already making... I'd need some more proof.
Yes, and I could try to provide you with that proof.
Oh, good.
As it pertains to the search... for extraterrestrial intelligence or SETI.
I've heard of it.
But why not actually have somebody who's the chair of SETI come on and help us with trying to figure out what if first contact with aliens
have
already been made?
Yeah, I think so. Let me tell you who he is. Dr. Andrew Semian is an astrophysicist and director of the Berkeley SETI Research Center. He also received his PhD in astrophysics at Berkeley in 2012. His research interests include high-energy time-variable celestial phenomena, astronomical instrumentation, and the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, SETI. He's the principal investigator for the Breakthrough Listen program. Breakthrough Listen is a project to search for intelligent extraterrestrial communications in the universe. With $100 million in funding and thousands of hours in dedicated telescope time on state-of-the-art facilities, it is the most comprehensive search for alien communications to date.
Dr. Semian, thanks for joining us here on What If Discussed.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, for those who are familiar with SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, you might be familiar with it through seeing the movie Contact back in the day with Jodie Foster playing the part of Jill Tarter. You might just be a real enthusiast that's passionate about this particular subject matter, or a science person that already knows that. But the core mission, and correct me if I'm wrong, was obviously to make contact with an extraterrestrial civilization through listening to radio signals out in space. And I'm sure I'm butchering that to some degree, but that process was pretty, as Jill Tarter described it on an episode of this show last year, she said something along the lines, it's like, you know, searching for life in a drop in the ocean. So it was a very small part of space you were looking at, but it sounds like technologically things have changed pretty dramatically. How significant are these changes to your core mission at SETI?
Indeed. As you said, SETI is an acronym. It stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. And our goal is to determine the prevalence of intelligent life in the universe. How common are intelligent species like our own? And we do that by looking for what we call techno signatures, signs of technology. The last 5 years or so has seen an absolute explosion in this field. And really, we have two things to thank for that. Number one, the discovery from the Kepler mission and other similar research that has told us definitively that exoplanets are the rule rather than the exception. Essentially, all of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy have planetary systems, and a fair fraction of those, maybe 15 or 20%, have planets something like the Earth, at least in terms of its size and its temperature. And we call these habitable planets, planets where life like our own could exist. The other thing that's changed is there's been a dramatic infusion of resources into the field. I'm the principal investigator for a program called Breakthrough Listen, which is a 10-year, $100 million SETI program, the most comprehensive, sensitive, and intensive search for extraterrestrial intelligence in history. Whereas at one time, we were lucky to get maybe 10 or 20 hours a year on large telescopes. With Breakthrough Listen, we have thousands of hours per year on multiple telescopes and really world-class digital instruments attached to those telescopes to look for these very, very weak distant signals.
Maybe you can tell us, you've been with SETI for about 15 years now, or over 15 years. Obviously, as you say, a lot has changed in that span, but I'm curious as to how people's attitudes have changed, especially in the scientific community, in terms of looking for extraterrestrial life. I'm guessing you've got a lot of recent converts or more believers in the last 15 years.
Yeah, it's an interesting history. You know, when SETI first began, what we call modern SETI, around 1960, there was actually quite a lot of mainstream scientific interest in this field. And that really continued until the mid-80s or so, when, unfortunately, the U.S. Congress took interest in SETI in a negative way and very famously terminated NASA's SETI program in 1993. And that was really the beginning of the kind of downturn, I think, in interest from the scientific community. But the exoplanet revolution has just absolutely changed, I think, everybody's view of the possibilities for not just intelligent life, but life in general beyond the Earth. And I think it really has sharpened this question, are we alone? And we're certainly benefiting from that in SETI in terms of our access to resources and access to telescopes.
And by the way, Exoplanet Revolution is the name of my next album.
Nice.
As a matter of fact, that is excellent. But it is interesting. And just to that point, because I think the number over 4,000 exoplanets comes out a lot. It sounds like what you're saying is, you know, that number is going to be outstripped to the power of, I don't know, 100. It sounds like we're probably getting to the point where we're going to be able to acknowledge maybe when James Webb comes out that we're probably looking at what, millions of exoplanets?
Yeah, you know, the Kepler mission was an incredibly exciting thing. And of course, you know, we all, you know, remember beginning in, you know, 2010, 2011, when it was almost like every week we heard about a new planet, a new Earth-like planet that was coming out. And as interesting as those individual discoveries are, the really important thing that Kepler taught us was a statistical calculation, was a statistical certainty. That all of the stars in the Milky Way galaxy have planetary systems. All 500 or 600 billion of those stars all have planetary systems, and there are, you know, literally hundreds of billions of planets, something like the Earth, out there. And our ability to observe them is constantly increasing. And the Breakthrough Listen program, with a new radio telescope that just got built in South Africa, we're going to be able to observe a million nearby stars. For radio technosignatures, which is a factor of 1,000 times more than we've ever been able to observe before.
Game-changing times. But, I mean, to Peter's point earlier, you know, scientific community attitudes, how have they changed? We know they've changed essentially because of what you've just acknowledged. It's almost impossible to refute the math. If anybody knows anything about theory of probability, you know, yeah. It's a stretch to suggest that there isn't. I mean, it's not just a stretch. I would argue it's imbecilic,
yeah.
But that's just my opinion. But the goalposts have been moved, I've noticed, because a lot of people before were like, well, that's crazy talk. And now they're, well, no, obviously there's intelligent life in the universe because the math is just too difficult to refute. But they will then jump to, but there's no real evidence that we have made first contact or that there's been any evidence that there's a connection with Earth and other intelligent civilizations or beings around the world. Now, some people, though, are positing different things, that there might be coding within the bacteria that's on this planet or even within our DNA that might suggest that there is already, and that's the big what if today, what if we've already made first contact with aliens? Where do you position yourself on this?
Well, I think the numbers are interesting. The math is interesting. We know with certainty that there is a lot of real estate out there. There are a lot of opportunities for life to arise and for life to thrive. But looking around at our own solar system, for the moment, we only see one example of life ever having arisen in our own solar system. And so, and we haven't yet been able to create life in the laboratory. So we believe that the probability that life emerges, given the necessary conditions, is some small number. Now, we don't know how small it is, but you multiply this very large number of possibilities by some small probability that life will arise, and we don't yet know whether the product of those two numbers is 1,000 or 100,000 or maybe one, and that one being us. So it's an incredible mystery, and indeed this is what SETI investigates. As to whether or not we have yet made contact, certainly we have no evidence of any life beyond the Earth so far, intelligent or otherwise. But I think the increased interest in this field is really motivating many scientists to look at all of the range of possibilities for how we might make contact, and I think that's one of the most exciting areas of research going on now is looking at different kinds of technosignatures, different kinds of radio signals that we might look for. Traditionally, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence focused on a fairly narrow range of radio frequencies and just a single signal type. And we're broadening that now to essentially the entire electromagnetic spectrum, even up to very high energies, to X-rays even, and looking for a much wider range of possible signals.
We know that SETI focuses more on detection, but like as you know, there are multiple probes headed to Mars as we speak, all in some way or another looking to find signs of life on the red planet. But is it possible that those missions might be limited by terracentrism, as it's called, meaning that we only know how to search for life as we know it?
Yeah, well, these are the unknown unknowns. We don't know what we don't know. All of the searches that we do for life are based on our experience with life, and that's just a necessary fact. Of how we conduct how we conduct science and how we conduct astrobiology. Now, there are certainly ways of trying to imagine other types of life or look at life in terms of its thermodynamic properties rather than the very specific kinds of things that life does here on Earth. It's also, I think, important to keep in mind that in any of our searches for life, we don't actually require as much similarity with life on Earth as we sometimes might imagine. Mm-hmm. For example, in SETI, the actual sort of motivations of the civilization that's producing the electromagnetic signals that we look for is actually completely unimportant to mm-hmm. to the searches that we do. It doesn't matter if ET is using lasers for communication or if they're using them for a giant laser light show in their planetary system
if ET is a being or a rock or a larva, I guess, too, right?
Well, again, that's right. I mean, we only look at the things that life does to its environment. And those things are not necessarily dependent on the life being DNA based or even using carbon chemistry. There are perhaps many chemistries that could drive the kinds of sort of disequilibriums that we look for when we conduct these searches. But it's certainly true that the closer the life is to our conception of life, or the kind of life that we have on Earth, the easier it will be for us to detect it.
Yeah, makes sense. But that is a good point. It makes a very good case for SETI's approach, because it's pretty agnostic as to who the life form is. It's just we're looking for the signal.
But mostly looking on exoplanets in the habitable zone first. Is it the easy first step?
So there are three horses in the race, so to speak, in the search for life. SETI, what I do, the in situ search for life, so sending probes to other bodies in our solar system, looking directly for life there, or observing those bodies with ground based or space based telescopes, and looking at exoplanet atmospheres, looking for biosignature gases in exoplanet atmospheres, and I think that those three methods, I think, at present, I would say have equal likelihood of success. The great advantage of SETI is that we can actually probe very, very large distances. We could detect the brightest radio transmitter that humans have ever produced on the other side of the Milky Way galaxy. So we can probe hundreds of billions of stars for the kinds of signals that we look for in SETI searches, whereas exoplanet atmospheres are a much more difficult thing to study. You need much larger telescopes, and there are perhaps only a few dozen exoplanets that are close enough to us that we might be able to detect biosignature gases in the next couple of decades.
And then probes, of course, also limited to the amount of probes we can send up to Mars or whatever, which is, again, pretty limited relative to being able to look at 100 billion stars. You mentioned the way exoplanet stories seem to almost feel like they were weekly for a while, right? It seemed like every time you were going online, you were finding out about a new exoplanet. And I would say similarly, these fast radio bursts or FRB stories over the last X amount of years, few years, where we'd be like, wow, there seems to be some signal coming from somewhere that got our attention enough to say, yeah, that seems sequential. The most recent one that's getting, I think, even more coverage that came out recently, that there was a 16-day lag that was, again, pretty sequential and non-random enough to say that looks artificial and created and potentially meant to signal us. What do you make of that particular story? But also, because I always think of our friends at SETI when I read these stories. I think you guys are out there looking at this type of stuff, and it feels, I don't know, it feels imminent that there's something about to happen. But what do you make of those types of developments recently?
Yeah, FRBs, fast radio bursts, are extraordinarily interesting objects. The discovery of FRBs was made in 2007, just at the kind of beginning of my astronomical career. So I've been fortunate to get to see the kind of progression over the last 13 or 14 years.
It's kind of funny. I can't almost hear that and not say, like, there's very few people where you'd say, you know, you've had an astronomical career. But in this case, it's literally you've had an astronomical career. Sorry, continue.
Indeed. FRBs are very, very interesting, and particularly the discovery that some of them repeat, which is a more recent discovery. Just in the last 4 or 5 years, we've known that FRBs repeat. It's important to mention, I think, that just because something repeats with some regularity doesn't necessarily mean that it's artificial. Very famously, when radio pulsars were first discovered, they were dubbed LGM. For little green men, because when they were first discovered, there was some thought that it was impossible for nature to produce something so regular, with a period of a second or so, or a few hundreds of milliseconds. But of course, now we know that radio pulsars are so regular because they come from very rapidly rotating neutron stars that have a very large moment of inertia and can be very, very stable and can produce very regular pulsations for tens or even hundreds of millions of years. I think it's most likely that we're going to find natural explanations for fast radio bursts. I sort of chose my phrasing carefully there. I think that probably there are multiple sources of these events. And in fact, there's already some rather strong evidence that at least some FRBs come from what are called magnetars, a very particular type of pulsar, a neutron star. But it's certainly very exciting to see it unfold. And, you know, from a rather kind of pragmatic perspective, the kinds of instruments and software that we use to study FRBs are very similar in many ways to the kind of software and instruments that we use for SETI. So it's a great kind of partnership, I think, between FRB science and SETI science and how we explore these sort of known phenomena and then look further afield to the kinds of things that we're interested in SETI.
Really cool. Dr. Simeon, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you the question before we let you go. Will we find evidence of alien life? And if so, when?
Yes. March 14th.
Excellent. If you were to predict, if you had any sort of the way things are going with SETI's research, with you know, the search for extraterrestrial life, would you hazard a guess as to, you know, what decade or what century we may find this information?
It's incredibly difficult to say. It's really the hardest question. But what I can say, with certainty, which is absolutely true, is that our odds of detecting intelligent life today are hundreds of times greater than they were 5 years ago, just by virtue of the much increased number of telescopes that we have available to us, how powerful our computers are. We can search, you know, 10 or 100 times more of the radio spectrum than we've ever been able to search before. I already mentioned that with Meerkat, we'll survey 1 million stars, 1 million nearby stars for radio signals, 1,000 times more than we've ever searched before. So the possibility and the probability, I should say, of detection has never been greater than it is today. But we don't know exactly how to scale that calculation.
Yeah, but that's good enough for me. Yeah. I love that answer because it's irrefutably exponentially larger, where I think we can all draw our own conclusion that it's not 100 years from now. It's not decades away. It certainly feels, at least for me, that it's closer to imminent than it's ever been. Let's just say that. And that still is a question mark. But the way you've sort of taken us through this clearly, articulately, and accessibly is exactly what we like to do here on What If Discussed, because as you can probably tell, Peter and I are not scientists.
No, but very curious.
Nor are we astronomical, but we really appreciate your insights today and the great work that SETI's doing and continuing to do. Where can people find out more about that?
So our websites, SETI.berkeley.edu or SETI.org, are great places to learn more about all the different experiments that we're doing.
Well, Dr. Simeon, a great ride. And again, Godspeed in terms of the search. And I look forward to clicking onto something one day where they're talking about you guys, you know, making that first contact. It'd be wildly exciting. So continued success with the work you're doing at SETI.
Thank you very much. I look forward to coming back and telling you all about it when we make that back.
Well, it sounds like we're getting a scoop.
Hopefully soon.
Excellent. Breaking news. Thanks a lot, Doctor.
Thank you.
So as usual with a big what if, not always necessarily answered because these are hypotheticals.
We're still in the search. That's why it's called the search for extraterrestrial intelligence.
But I mean, for me, the takeaway is that the search has never been more alive. You've never had more money behind it. You've never had more technology behind it. You've never had more general telescope, like not only advanced telescopes, but as he talked about back in the day, they were lucky to get 10 hours of telescope time over the course of X amount.
So the belief behind, you know, not just the belief within the community, but the belief by the government and I guess by the people who hold those purse strings to this is like, yeah, we should be looking into this and we should be spending money on this.
So in a world where people, you know, often argue, why are we even sending people to space? Like we need things done here. Why should we be wasting money on whatever? And politically, that's become a bit of a hot potato. So if somebody was coming in making a pitch, you know, for $100 million to search for extraterrestrial intelligence, It's not a PowerPoint, Keith. Like, it's whatever you've come
It's reams and reams of
It's got to be compelling proof, enough to, yes, exactly. Like, pointing in a direction that A, it's imminent, but B, that it's important that we do understand this, know it, and do whatever we can to prepare for this new world.
Is it possible there's also a little bit of information that we haven't found out that's behind some of this? Like, they have some initial proof of something, or they have a focus at least. I don't want to start a conspiracy, but...
But I mean, it would be, to me, it would be likely. Like, of course, and again, it's not going to be something that if you do have evidence of something like that, you're just going to say, well, you know what? Let's set up a press conference and go out and tell everybody. Because the ramifications afterwards of people kind of going crazy, it would be, especially if you're not sure, but you're sort of like, well, that's pretty whatever. But all that to say, if you got $100 million of funding over 10 years, some people would argue that's not tons, there's whatever. But in a time where, again, people could say we could find other uses of $100 million, I would suspect that you had to make a pretty compelling case. And regardless, I'm excited about the fact that, as Dr. Simeon said, it's not really a question of if, but when. And that when has been moved up exponentially just because of
technology,
the resources, and the commitment. Exciting times to be searching for
extraterrestrials
intelligence.
No doubt. Yeah, and so not if, but when.
That's I mean, he was, you know, he's a smart guy. He's running a big organization. He has to be somewhat political. He's not going to commit to a date, as he was, you know, which was great. March, whatever.
What was the date? He said March 14th.
He was like March 14th. I was like, oh, wow, set your calendar for next year. But he was essentially, you know, he has... It came as close to saying is it's not if, but when. And it seems, because again, you could say that could be 100 years. But I think we would all agree that even with all of these different things coming out over the last X amount of years and months, that it's, let's just say this, it's never felt more imminent than it does now.
Yeah, it's going to happen.
But that's a story.
That is a story for another what if. But yeah, now Dr. Simeon talks about searching for extraterrestrial life. If you want to know more about the search for extraterrestrial life, and also maybe whether or not there's already evidence the contact has been made, well, stick around for the extended audio version of What If Discussed. You can get there by clicking on the link just below here. If you're already listening to the audio podcast, don't go looking around for a link because there won't be one. Yes. But if you're watching the video podcast, there's a link to the audio podcast. And that's where you'll find our discussion with science author Sarah Scholes. And we'll be discussing her book, They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. So just click on the link below. Sarah Scholes is a Denver-based freelance science writer, a contributing writer at Wired Science, and a contributing editor at Popular Science. Sarah was once an associate editor at Astronomy and a public education liaison at the National Radio Astronomy Observatory in Green Bank, West Virginia. She's also the author of the book Making Contact, Jill Tarter and the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Her newest book, They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers, takes a deep dive into the diverse and fascinating UFO community.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for joining us today on What If Discussed.
Thanks so much for having me.
So it's been a long and wild ride, let's say, for, let's say, the subject of UFOs and specifically the UFO community. It's essentially over 73 years old, I guess, if we put the marker at Roswell, 1947 crash is where the sort of the real growth in flying saucer sightings and UFO communities begin. And of course, at the least, this community has been viewed as fringe. At the worst, they've been marginalized, they've been ridiculed. You've spent a lot of time with different parts of the UFO community. First of all, how do you feel more recent announcements out of the Pentagon and the US military have changed them? And how has that information being received?
Yeah, so starting in December 2017, there were some revelations about very official interests into UFOs, beginning with the revelations about this program called the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, which there's a little bit of debate about what it actually did, but in general, people report that it investigated UFO sightings, particularly among military personnel. And then after that, Congress people got briefings about UFOs. There have been official statements of interest from politicians and people in the military. And then most recently, we found out that the Navy will be leading what they call an unidentified aerial phenomena task force to detect, analyze, maybe identify or not.
Seems like a conscious rebranding there too, Sarah, from let's just get away from UFOs.
Yeah.
And what, anybody have any ideas? How about unidentified aerial phenomena, UAP? I love it.
It's catchy. But yeah, all of that and some of the rebranding has taken a little bit of the stigma away from it because, these are serious people with serious jobs in the government paying attention to this topic that, a lot of people on the internet and in small kind of fringe groups have been paying attention to for a long time. And then now here are these serious people. And I think that has done a lot for the legitimacy of the community.
Sarah, our big what if today on the show is what if we've already made contact with these aliens? But I'm guessing that's a given with most of the people that you spent time with writing this book. What's the range of beliefs within the UFO community about this question? What do they believe?
Yeah, so it really does run a full spectrum from people on the kind of what you would call debunking or skeptical end who take a lot of UFO sightings and kind of tear them apart, but I think maybe from a place of love where they only want to be left with the really, really credible ones so that we're not lost in a bunch of hoaxes and fictions. Then you kind of have the people who are very agnostic about UFOs but interested in them. They don't have any hypotheses about what they are that they ascribe to, but they just, they think this is a persistent human phenomenon and they want to get to the bottom of it. Then you kind of have some people who are maybe casual believers. And actually, I just looked at the latest poll, I think. It was a Pew Research poll conducted recently that said a third of Americans think that UFOs have been here and are extraterrestrial. But, most people aren't going to do anything about that. They're just going to think that. And then I would say you have the true believers who are just for sure know that aliens have driven spaceships here. And some of those people think those are their physical kind of nuts and bolts craft, and some of them have more maybe wild ideas about how they're manifestations of our own consciousness in some way. But there's a lot going on out there.
So nobody's really believing it's little green men. It's more they've got sophisticated beliefs of what they actually are appearing as.
Yeah, I mean, some people do subscribe to the little green men or the little gray men or the tall blonde men, depending on who you ask. But I think that's a function of, we don't have very much hard data on any of this. And so everybody just kind of gets to believe what they like to believe most.
Well, I'm guessing from that standpoint, you spent, again, as Peter said, you spent a lot of time with different, let's say, subcultures or segments within the UFO community, the greater UFO community, if there is one. I don't know if there's an association yet. If not, maybe Peter and I, there's an opportunity
might be.
There.
I wouldn't discount
but
a membership card.
Yeah, but I mean, why not, right?
But we don't want to get into mocking them.
There's a business opportunity because associations, they come in, there's membership dues every year. We have the conference.
Lucrative.
It's called What If
yeah.
Aliens Existed? Bam.
Bingo. Cha-ching.
Cha-ching. But seriously, like stories, we've all heard and watched different documentaries and heard, very interesting stories. But you would be I think, obviously, with access to people that have probably had experiences, whether it be, abduction experiences, according to them, or seeing UFOs. What are some of the more compelling stories that you came across?
Yeah, I mean, I think in very modern times, since these military revelations came out, a lot of people see the sightings by the pilots of fighter jets to be some of the most credible ones out there. And they largely center around this kind of sighting called a Tic Tac, which I guess looks like the breath mint Tic Tac, that could kind of accelerate very fast and change altitude very quickly, change direction very quickly. And these are sightings that are coming from people who fly jets all the time and see a lot of stuff. And so people find those to be credible. I actually think what's most interesting about the UFO sightings I've heard about is that, you know, yes, you have the people who say there was a big black triangle hanging out over my house all night, or the aliens showed up in my bedroom. But most UFO sightings are just lights in the sky moving in a way that don't doesn't make sense to people. Then they appear and they disappear. And that's kind of, there's not a lot of data there, but it is what most people relate seeing. And I've seen some things like that. I went out to Area 51 when I was working on this book, and just looking up at the sky, there was this whole kind of net or matrix of little white lights that appeared and took over half the sky, kind of moved in unison.
Wow.
And then just disappeared. And you know, I think that was some kind of military test, but it's a very strange thing to see. And there's a historian named Greg Agigian who's working on a global history of UFOs. And he says the most important thing about a UFO sighting is not that it appears in the sky, but that it disappears, and that is what really gets to people who see them.
Oh, yeah. That's crazy. We've had Bill Nye, the science guy, on the show just last week, actually, and he's been on record saying that he, like most people in the scientific community today, believe that there is intelligent life mm-hmm. in the universe, and that we're not alone. Other people like Neil deGrasse Tyson have said mm-hmm. similar things.
And Bill Nye said it on this show.
Yeah, said it on this show. And now maybe these guys aren't the most respected scientists in that field, but how does it feel just having, you know, personalities or some celebrities, some people with followings come out and agree to this, agree that there is intelligent life? How does that affect the UFO community? How do they think it helps them as in the way they're being viewed?
Yeah, I mean, I think the scientific consensus has changed quite a bit since that, 70 or more years ago when the first modern UFO sightings happened. Back then, we didn't know that there were any planets beyond the solar system at all. We hadn't found the kind of extreme life that we find in very unpleasant places on Earth, which kind of tell us that maybe aliens could live in mm-hmm. places we think are totally inhospitable. Now we've discovered many, many, many planets and all these organisms, and the idea that life could exist out in the universe is much more mainstream than it was back then. And I think from the scientific perspective and the perspective of people who do SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, you know, their idea is the aliens are maybe or probably out there, but they're hanging out on their own planets or in wider space. And where they differ from the UFO community is that the UFO community says, you know, they have come here in particular. And I think that's the part that scientists in general have a hard time with, because especially astronomy is kind of based around the idea that the solar system is very average, and the idea that we're special and that aliens yeah. might pick us to come visit is kind of a little bit anathema to the way things work. So that's the main difference, but I think they're kind of on the same page about whether they're out there at all.
So again, the book is called They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. So I will ask you, Sarah Scholes, are they, and I am using air quotes here because I don't know what they means, but are they already here in your opinion? And also, why do we see saucers?
See, I shouldn't have titled the book that, because I don't have all the answers. I mean, in my opinion, if they are the aliens who drive spaceships, I don't think we have enough evidence to say that they are here, personally. I don't personally think they are, but I have to admit the possibility that I also don't know that for sure. And I think, you know, we see saucers, we could be seeing saucers because saucers are there to see. But also, I think we see saucers because we hear about somebody else seeing saucers. And so then when we see something in the sky that looks weird, in general, our first assumption is not, maybe that's like a plane at a weird angle or something like that. It's, oh, you know, other people have seen UFOs and maybe this is a UFO. And, you know, it's kind of it injects a little bit of mystery and excitement into daily life to think that that could be going on. And I think that that's appealing no matter who you are.
Well, and I mean, we talked about why, you know, certain people, let's say the Bill Nyes of the world, but other, you know, big time mainstream scientists, the math is overwhelming. That's the difference between where we were certainly in 1947 and where we're at now, is that the amount of galaxies since Hubble went out, basically, you know, we're aware that there's some 200 billion galaxies, at least, that we can see. Wait till James Webb telescope comes out.
Yeah.
That, you know, the planets are innumerable, the stars are innumerable. So it now just seems to make mathematical sense. We're not alone, but
we know we're not alone, but we're just waiting. Yeah. Are there actually people visiting us?
And I suspect, to your point, Sarah, I don't have any more, you know, sort of evidence than you do either. And, but it must be an interesting time to be in the UFO community. So an interesting time to read a book about the UFO community. Again, it's called They Are Already Here, UFO Culture and Why We See Saucers. Sarah, where can people find the book and where can people follow your work?
Yeah, there's one answer that's good for both of those. I have a website, sarahskulls.com, and it has all of my writing, including all the places you can buy the book. And I think the most common places are Amazon and a website called IndieBound, IndieBound. I'm on Twitter at SkullsSarah.
And if they order the book from you directly, because I know we've had other offers say that it's probably better than just going through Amazon. Is that would you prefer that?
Sure. Yeah. It's published by Pegasus Books, and there's a link to that on my website too. But if you Google the name of the book and Pegasus, it should come up.
Okay. Well, we will do exactly that. We recommend that people sort of check it out. Great stuff. Look forward to whatever you're working on going forward, because you've done great work. Thanks for sort of bringing us down this rabbit hole today on What If Discussed.
The truth is out there.
It's the ultimate what if.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sarah Scholes.
Thank you.
So great stuff with Sarah Scholes. And of course, earlier, great stuff with Andrew Simeon. And Sarah mentioned that, you know, she had access, and I can't believe I haven't been there myself. She went to Area 51.
So cool.
With some, you know, some people, because a lot of people go there all the time. So there's a whole sort of community of people that camp out and look up at the stars. It's the desert. It's cool. And yes, you would be more likely to see things in the desert anyways, because the sky's lit up, but especially around that very legendary area. What she described for me was pretty, I mean, that's
the lights.
Yeah, the lights in a certain pattern and whatever. But in the end, she didn't sound, you know, ultra convinced that she's necessarily seen something that was extraterrestrial, nor that extraterrestrials have been here.
I would find it strange that, what is it about Area 51? Is it like the Bermuda Triangle? Like, why do sightings keep happening in that area?
Well, I mean, I certainly believe, and this is also an extension of why these, you know, unidentified aerial phenomenon programs and the U.S.
I like
military.
That name.
I love it. Yeah. Look, it needed a rebrand. UFO is too stigmatized. You can't get a serious conversation going with too many people. So I think it's a smart idea. It's really very smart. And it also, though, was accompanied by, you know, of course, the I think it was the Department of Defense, the U.S. Navy, who released those really compelling videos with audio from Navy pilots saying, what the hell is that? And
the
all
tic-tac.
That was a game changer, the old tic-tac video.
I like the tic-tac because I can imagine that their breath from other worlds is
also a long journey.
Galactically horrible.
Yes, galactically brutal breath. A scope commercial, perhaps, if they get here right out of the day. You know what? They'll need an agent. So again, a possible opportunity for you and I. But it did remind me when she was talking about that, Sarah was talking about her experience, it reminded me that I have other friends that have some wild experiences, like really unbelievably compelling stuff.
Sightings,
again, like she described, encounter, not necessarily a ship landed, whatever, but sightings in the sky where, you know, some stuff that was happening, pattern stuff, disappearing stuff.
And I've seen, you know, I haven't seen enough that couldn't be probably explained away with shooting star type stuff. But have you or anybody you know seen something compelling enough that got your attention?
No, I have never met anyone in my, don't have anyone in my close circle of friends mm-hmm. that has encountered anything or has cited anything other than say maybe what a shooting star, what they thought might have been.
Sure.
But nothing that has appeared and glowed and like something looking otherworldly.
Yeah.
It's more like a, you know, bright light in the sky for seconds on.
There's tons of really, I mean, you know, there's some more famous sightings than others. But the one that still, I don't think gets enough attention, although it's gotten a lot of attention. It was, you know, ABC 2020, I think Dateline did something. Everybody did something, was the lights in Phoenix, Arizona about whatever it was 20 years ago. But interestingly enough, what happened, if you don't know the story, there was this unbelievable situation, like the entire, I think it's Phoenix, but in Arizona, like the entire city was like watching this for hours, that there was this, you know, triangulated, mothershipy looking thing in the sky. And it was just sitting there and people were, so it got national attention. It was a huge story. And then the governor of Arizona, and if you can watch this, you can Google this, came out, he actually showed up at the press conference, I believe in an alien suit, like a little complete mockery. Everybody laughed and whatever. He comes out later on. Not only he, but I believe if it wasn't John McCain, who was a senator in Arizona, it's another high ranking, somebody along the lines of, and even Jimmy Carter, actually, if you want to Google Jimmy Carter and a group he's with, but he has a sighting. There's a bunch of them in a specific place that, and he didn't talk about it till later. But the governor of Arizona who mocked it in the press conference, or he was the mayor of Phoenix, I can't remember which, comes out later, a few years later, and admits that he lied.
It was a diversion.
That he saw it. He said he didn't see it. He saw it. And he came out later and said, I didn't want to be mocked. I was, you know, whatever. But he said, no, I saw it. It was this, it was that, whatever. And interestingly enough, you still hear people say, well, we haven't had compelling enough sightings to feel. Now, back to why we were talking about UAE or Unidentified Aerial Phenomenon, UAPs, gonna have to get used to that.
Yeah.
The inference that I think Sarah was making, but also others have made, is the reason the interest is picked up with the US military is that perhaps they're seeing things that they can't identify. They don't necessarily believe it's off-world, but they're concerned that there's other military technology on this planet that they don't know where it's coming from.
Did they not just come out and said that they saw something that was definitely not constructed on this planet?
So these are things you can't take this lightly. Like, I mean, I saw that it was like the seventh story on, you know, whatever it was, CNN. I was like, there was six more important
things
stories
than that. Yeah.
Than these really? Guys coming this out is- and saying, we found a craft that wasn't necessarily built on Earth. It was like, wow, you'd think that would be breaking news, but it wasn't. Oddly enough, but it certainly feels that even in the lifetime of us doing this show, that there's going to be something that takes this entire thing to the next level. But for now, we'll have to settle with most people, as Sarah Scholl cited, you know, there's a poll, and I've heard well over 50 and 60%, well over 60% polls say that they believe in intelligent life off this planet. A third of the nation, I think she said, believes that there's been UFOs visiting here. And again, we've heard Bill Nye's of the world say on our show, of course there's intelligent life.
I mean, they say maybe why would somebody visit us? Our solar system is so boring and we are so boring.
But
that's one sighting or 100 sightings. Perhaps there's 20 billion UFOs out there. So 100 sightings is not necessarily a big deal. And they're not necessarily studying us as close as we might think. They're probably out there all over should they exist, they're probably out there all over the universe exploring.
Well, look, what are we?
Dimensions, in different time dimensions.
And that's a whole, that's a what if for another day too, because I think that's the missing piece. Everybody tries to talk about, oh, it'll take X amount of light years in a spaceship. Like, are you kidding me? We're still talking about there's wormholes, all this other stuff. Like, again, let's try to remember we don't know everything.
We don't
let's
know start anything. With that. We know 1% of 1%.
And so there's going to be, oh, that's how they did it. Well, you know, of course it'll occur to us after. But as we talked about earlier in the show with Dr. Simeon, there's three separate missions that have been, I think, are already off to Mars. I think China has one. I think the Middle East or UAE or Saudi Arabia or somebody has one, and the US has one going back to Mars. If we're sending rovers and stuff to Mars, we're sending people to the moon, we're sending probes to Saturn, then why wouldn't we think these other intelligent beings are sending, right, you know, missions around the quote unquote universe, the galaxy, to see what their neighborhood looks like? It just makes sense. We're already doing it.
Yeah. I mean, we're doing near planets to us, and we haven't
discovered anything beyond it. But because we only have that ability.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. But, and I guess the question is what's so interesting about us that they would want to discover us?
Well, I like to think I'm pretty interesting.
Well, this is our small thinking, is we don't understand that there are, could be things in the universe that are a billion times smarter than us.
Yes.
Things that are constructed a billion times better, sturdier, mm-hmm, smarter than what we've constructed. And we might just look like small ants and protozoa to aliens.
That feels about right.
And perhaps they're not even physical beings.
Yeah.
Right?
Entities.
That's a story for another what if.
It is.
Anyways, I'd like to thank Dr. Andrew Simeon once again for joining us on What If Discussed today, and Sarah Scholes. If you want more What If, well, you should sign up for the What If Explorers Club newsletter for tons of cool science stuff and to find out what Richard and I are doing behind the scenes here.
And today,
and
wildly interesting. You can't believe what we're doing, but you'll have to sign
up. I'm glad you can't see us right now. You'll sign up at whatifshow.com. And do you want to know how to survive, say, being buried alive, how to survive, yikes, a piranha feeding frenzy?
Yes, I
do. Or maybe survive being the last person on Earth?
Yes,
which of those three is your biggest fear?
Well, the buried alive with a bullet. There's nothing close. There's nothing
buried
more
alive
terrifying.
With a bullet, or just
well I mean, I would rather somebody put a bullet in me than bury me alive. Let's say that.
That'd be the most frightening thing, and just being left in the dark to
I'm honestly, as you asked me the question, I felt terror.
Ugh. Well, if you want to know how to survive it, subscribe to our new channel.
I will.
How to Survive. It's on YouTube. Go to YouTube to find out. And that's it for today's show. We'll see you next time on What If Discussed.